Hello, my name is Phoebe Smith, and I want to tell you about my book, Wayfarer, Love, Loss and Life on Britain's Ancient Paths. Wayfarer tells the story of how I lost my way and found it again by walking the ancient pilgrim paths in Britain and elsewhere. Along my journey, I found hope, confronted past experiences, and learned more about myself than I ever thought I would. My book, Wayfarer, is out now and available in hardback, ebook, and audiobook.
On this month's Wonder Woman podcast,
trying to show the community that they don't have to just throw away things, they can use them. They can use them and do nice art with it, something that they can also sell and benefit, you know.
I meet a former street kid in South Africa who works with underprivileged homeless children, teaching them camera and craft skills to help them turn their lives around. Meanwhile, my Wonder Woman correspondent, Daniel Nielsen, travels to the remote and wild Torngat Mountains National Park in Canada to search for icebergs, whales, polar bears and people.
When I was a child, I thought we were the only existing Inuit in the world.
And I catch up with Olympic athlete and world rowing champion Helen Glover to talk about how much exploring she got to do when competing and ask how travel has changed since she became a mum.
It made me look at things a really different way, and actually I enjoyed the things I saw more. It slowed me down. It made me really take in the views.
Also coming up, my regular travel hack reveals the top tips on how to haggle in a souk and walk away with a price that leaves both you and the vendor happy. Prepare to dream of a city break with a difference with my 10 best wilderness-adjacent metropolises in the world. And with my wonderful podcast partners, Rohan, I'll be talking the best travel gear for a life on the road. Finally, I'll be revealing this episode's Wonder Woman of the Month, the traveller whose name is lost in the history books. You're listening to the Wonder Woman podcast, an audio travel magazine with me, Phoebe Smith, exploring off-the-beaten-track destinations, wild spaces, wildlife encounters, and the unsung heroes behind conservation efforts. Come wander with me.
So here I am. I'm sat in this pretty old-looking twin otter at the moment, just flying over the boreal forest. We've just taken off from Goose Bay. We're going to have a stop in Nain before we have another stop up to the Torngat Mountains National Park base camp, where we take a boat. We can see the pilot. His name's Kevin. He keeps fiddling around with this really old-looking equipment. It's a noisy old plane. In front of me, all of our bags are strapped down, but there's a pretty unbelievable view of lakes and forest all around below us. It could be more Indiana Jones if it tried, really.
When I mentioned I was going to the Torngat Mountains National Park, even my Canadian friends could only really return a blank stare. In a country of remote wilderness parks, the Torngats barely registered. And they were so remote and so wild and not easy to get to. I'd hop from Toronto to Ottawa, to Halifax to Goose Bay, and now in a twin otter to Nain, the last town on this northern tip of Labrador. And then finally to a Cold War airstrip, long enough for jets, near the base camp, a scientific outpost that welcomed visitors throughout the summer. Even from the airstrip to the base camp required a boat or a ride on the resident helicopter. I'd come to see polar bears and whales, icebergs and the northern lights, and wow, over the coming days we would see all those and in abundance. But that's not the story we're telling today. What we discovered, an international group of five journalists lucky enough to make the trip, was a story of belonging and of survival, of hope and of forgiveness. And as soon as we arrived, we caught up with a man who would be our main guide over the next week.
My name is Gary Bakey. I'm the superintendent for the Torngat Mountains National Park, and I live in Nain, Labrador. The creation of the park is because of a natural area. For us, it's that the people that work at the Torngat Mountains National Park, and the vision of the park was to ensure that the Inuit homeland was kept intact, the story of the Inuit homeland is told, and that it also creates a means for Inuit to get back into an Inuit homeland. So by creating the park, it was always the vision that what we would try to do, to the best of our ability anyway, is to ensure that Inuit had a connection, to keep the connection, and to pass that connection on. Mm-hmm. We do have Inuit working at base camp. We do have an Inuit staff that work at the Parks Canada positions for the national park. And we also have elders coming in. Mm-hmm. And we also have the youth coming in. The vision of the park is to show the park through an Inuit cultural lens.
The Tongat Mountains Base Camp on the southern edge of the park is a partnership between Parks Canada and the Base Camp. From here, they offer excursions into the park, but they also host elders and youth from nearby communities, as well as musicians. Listen to episode 8 of Wonder Woman to hear the amazing throat singers. And from here, Parks Canada steward an area of 9,700 square kilometres of spectacular wilderness. The next day, we boarded on the boat Safe Passage and headed to Rose Island, a sacred place for Inuit for thousands of years. No one lives on this beautiful tract of land anymore, except for the polar bears. But it was the birthplace of one of Base Camp's guests, Sophie Keenan, and also the site of one of the most shameful episodes in the history of the area. Walking around, Gary, our guide, stops at a pile of rocks and explains.
It's a grave with 1,300 individuals. The 113 were taken from this area right here on this island back in 1969-70 by a paleontologist who was working, who got permission from an archaeologist who was actually working on the island, digging up some, excavating some sad houses.
Gary was instrumental in bringing back these remains. He spent years tracking them, being blanked by archaeologists who really knew the true story. The remains of these people were sent to Toronto and eventually tracking them down to St. John's. Parts of them sat on desks of archaeologists in the country. But a plea to the tourism minister was heeded, and eventually the remains of the Inuit of this land were brought back.
And this place used to be full of Inuit, full. All of the islands, the mainland, you go anywhere where you think it's a good land and you think you're the first person on that land, all you got to do is take a look around you and you'll see evidence of Inuit from the past, like for hundreds of years, and in fact probably 1,000 years. Human history on this island goes back 6,000 years. So it's been a long time. For me, it's personally anyway, I find this a very powerful spot. And there's, you know, on days, especially you get a really nice, beautiful day, I can actually hear kids playing on the beach there, right? And I can see the kids and the women down on the beach playing around. I can see the Hayaks and some of the Umiaks out in the water there, carrying on their daily lives. Kids running around and collecting mussels.
Sophie was one of those children, playing on the beach, collecting mussels. And then the Moravian missionaries arrived, and with the Canadian government, they moved her and her family, and dozens more like her, from Rose Island to Hebron, a few hours boat ride to the south. And that evening, after playing Inuit games organised by the youth, I caught up with Sophie. Remarkably, the move from Rose Island to Hebron wasn't the only time her and her family was evicted.
My name is Sophie Keelan. I was born in Rose Island, Sutlik Bay. Mm-hmm. It's called Sallikuluk in Inuktitut. From Rose Island, like we were in, at the time when I was a child, we were nomadic Eskimos at the time,
yeah.
Traveling from place to place, season to season, survival for food. It was our way of life, so we were accustomed to it. And it didn't seem hard for us, like, but for hunting wise, we had to hunt to survive on the land because we have no stores,
yeah.
Nowhere else to go. And we thought we were the only existing Inuit in the world.
When was the change from a nomadic in your life?
1950s.
Okay,
I remember back in 1952-53, Inuit started moving into communities because they requested by the Moravian missionary because their children had to attend school.
And where did you move to?
Hebron.
Hebron.
Yeah.
How long did you stay in Hebron?
I was probably 5 years old because at the time I started school, I was only 5 years old then.
Okay.
Then when I was 11, I remember we had to relocate to another community by the request of the government officials.
Okay.
And the Moravian missionary.
Do you remember that time when you had to move?
Yes, I remember. It's like I can like as if I'm there right now. It was a very difficult time for all the parents and all the children. Families were separated. We lost our Inuit identity, and we lost our friends. We lost our member of the families. We had to pack our personal belongings, and yeah, women and the children were they went on a ship. And I remember brass band playing on the wharf of Hebron, and I remember a song they played.
We travelled by boat to Hebron, past more icebergs, some the size of mansions. We saw whales and dolphins. Hebron itself is a village lost to time. The stores and meeting places have fallen, and the houses just a shell, left to the cold and wind, exactly as the day they left. The church, however, is being restored. And Gus was born in Hebron, and for the last 17 years he's dedicated his life to restoring the church. The day that we went saw the first service held there since the community was moved on all those years ago. A brass band plays, and Gus explains why this is his life's mission.
When we got separated, the whole family got separated from, like say, they were going to Nain, Hopedale, Makovic, Northwest River, and Goose Bay. And some went up further north, George River, Goodjock, and I believe Iqaluit. Mm-hmm. That's how we were separated. And at that time, like I said, 1999, the first time we'd seen each other in 40 years. So there was something else. It was really good to see people we didn't, like if we didn't know them, mm-hmm. but they were still our cousins. Yeah. Our friends, our relatives. You know, even though we've seen each other in 40 years, still, like in my heart or in my mind, I seem to know them, because they're all from the same family.
Yeah, of course.
So that was good about it, good thing about it for me.
Yeah. And so now you're involved in the restoration of this church and a community centre, and this is the last remaining permanent building in Hebron.
Yeah.
That's right. And so what does it mean for you to be involved in restoring this beautiful church?
When I think about that, you know, it always makes me feel good saying that I'm telling people that I'm home, place where I was born. And, you know, that's one good thing about it. If my parents were alive, my grandparents were alive today, they'd be proud of what I'm doing. You know, that makes me proud, because every time I see people from, I've seen people from all over the world, you know, tell me that I'm doing a good job. And I'm really proud of that.
Yeah.
I need to keep on going. I need to finish what I started, but I don't know how long I'm going to last. That's my problem.
That was my Wonder Woman correspondent, Daniel Nielsen, reporting from the Tongat Mountains in the Canadian province of Labrador and Newfoundland, in association with Destination Canada. It's a place where few have been, but all who have talk about it with a certain glint in their eye, knowing that they've been privileged to experience somewhere very special. Now, somewhere I found to be very special in my travels is a souk. My favourite is still the first one I ever experienced over 10 years ago when I was in Marrakesh. The smells, the chaos, the chatter and healthy banter, I absolutely adored it. But I soon realised I was in the minority. A lot of people, particularly from the Western world, really struggle with shopping in places where there are no fixed prices. In fact, it terrifies them. But there's really nothing to be afraid of. In fact, armed with some top tips, it can be one of the most memorable places you visit on your travels, whether you're in Egypt, Arabia or beyond. Want to ensure you leave the next one with a big grin on your face? Here's my travel hack of the month, with my top tips on how to haggle in a souk. We've all been there. wandering amid the rich tapestries, spices and fabrics of a busy souk or bazaar, and spotted something we like. Then, before we even had chance to work out which one we actually want, suddenly the vendor is upon us, plying us with mint tea and promising us a deal of a lifetime. The whole procedure for haggling can be stressful for some, especially if you're from a country where fixed prices is the order of the day. But here's a secret for you. Haggling is actually a game, and it's a huge part of the cultural experience of going to so many places around the world. Want to know how you can go from feeling out of your depth to actually enjoying it? Listen up. Tip 1. Once you've spotted the thing you want, don't appear too enthusiastic, no matter how much you feel. Summon upon your best acting skills. Sure, it's okay, but vocalise how unsure you are. Do I really need it? Did I see one I like better elsewhere? This is the start of the game. Tip 2, don't be the first to suggest a price. You'll be pushed to, but you don't want to set the starting figure, as it will only go up from there. Insist on them being the one beginning the money game. Tip 3, never accept the first price given. This will be wildly overpriced. Many decades ago, someone said of haggling that you should expect to pay half the amount first proposed by the vendor. But here's the thing, the vendors heard this too, and so now they offer a ridiculously high sum, hoping you'll still be overpaying by a lot to get the item that you're after. Tip 4, have in your head the price you want to pay and no higher, and start your price way lower than that. That way, as you and the vendor negotiate the price, it will get closer to what you hope to pay, rather than the price you said straight away. Tip 5, think about what it's worth to you. There's bound to be a vast deal of difference between what the vendor paid for it and what you will eventually pay for it. The trick is to know what you think it's worth, and then don't try and second guess it. Stick with the value you've placed on it. Tip 6, consider buying in bulk. I try and go to a place where they have multiple items I want. You are far more likely to get a great bargain if you're getting a lot of things at once from the same vendor. Tip 7, show them the money. Before heading to any souk, bazaar or street vendor, I change any big bills to small ones, keeping different size bills in different pockets. Then, when I know that I've reached my limit price, I pull out the notes to show them exactly how much I'm going to pay. Many will be tempted once they see the colour of money and realise that you are serious. Tip 8, walk away. And I mean this actually. They will say all sorts, "You're crazy, I'll be losing money at that price." You get the idea. But the fact is, they won't sell it to you if they were. So show them you're serious, shrug your shoulders and leave the shop. I've actually been chased after this tactic, and about 9 times out of 10 always get the price I want afterwards. So definitely it's worth a try. And finally, tip 9, always remain friendly and smile. It goes such a long way. And remember to put everything in context. I was once with a girl who argued for 10 minutes over what was actually the equivalent of small change to her, but would have made a world of difference to that vendor. So, know when to back down. In short, you both should leave with smiles on your faces. That was my travel hack of the month, the insider knowledge I offer every single episode so that you can create lasting memories for all the right reasons on your trips. Now, speaking of lasting memories, one of the places that always sends me home with a myriad of smile-inducing recollections is South Africa. Yes, I love the wildlife there, and of course the scenery, coast, mountains and winelands. It is breathtaking. But when it comes to smiles, it's the people I meet there that always leave a lasting impression. Last year, I discovered a wonderful initiative called I Was Shot in Joburg. It's essentially a shop selling photographs, artwork and memorabilia. But there's a difference. It was started for and is run by street kids who are trained to use cameras and learn craft skills to enable them to earn money and turn their lives around. I met one of them, called Jackson, who explains the idea behind it.
Okay, so I'm here in Johannesburg, I Was Shot in Johannesburg, yes. And I'm here with the person who started this. Yes. And what's your name?
My name is Cesar, you can call me Jackson.
and what made you start I Was Shot in Joburg?
Actually, it was Bernard, my boss, who came to our shelter. We live, he found us in Hillbro in a shelter called Twilight Children. So he came there with disposable cameras. So every Monday we'd go out and take these wonderful pictures that you see behind you. And we did that for a whole year. And then after a year, in 2009, in December, we had our first exhibition here in Arton, Maine.
Yeah.
That was our first space. So that's where we had our first exhibition. Then from there we decided that, you know what, we want to grow the project a little bit because we just don't want to sell pictures anymore. We want to make more. So we decided to do art well. Also, we did art and we did a lot of handwork. As you can see, a lot of our work is handwork. And we've got post books and joisters, which are also handmade. So most of the stuff that you see here is handmade.
And a lot of it is from, like, there's a guy over there who's making a picture from recycled plastic.
Yes.
So is there a lot of focus on that?
Yes, recycling as well. We're focusing on that as well. You know, trying to, like, change our environment because, you know, Joburg isn't that clean, but we're trying to, like, bring some positive into it, trying to show the community that they don't have to just throw away things. They can use them. They can use them and do nice art with it, something that they can also sell and benefit, you know. Yeah, just trying to lower the crime a little bit in South Africa and also the unemployment, just to give out some hope, you know, to the youth. Because there's a lot of unemployment in South Africa at the moment because people do go to school, they do get qualified, they do get... They do go to varsity, they do get all, but they can't find a job, even though they are qualified, but there's not enough.
No.
So instead of that, you can also do other things. Be creative, handwork and fashion as well, and also photography, that's what they also do. So yeah, just to bring some hope out there, you know, so it's not the end of the world, you can still do something else.
And the artists who are all here, are they, I noticed on the sign that you have, they're all street children.
Yes. They are all from the street.
And what sort of age is the youngest and the oldest?
Where we're staying, from the street, normally it's from, I can say from 10 until 16. But basically, yeah, that's the age that you mostly find boys who are on the street. Some have run away from home because maybe they had an abusive mom, abusive dad. And maybe that would be the case. Or some of them, they just don't want to listen to their parents. They don't want to be told. They just want, you know, to live their own lives at such a young age. So, you know, it's like that. Some are on drugs. You know, it's a lot.
And so this project then gives them the opportunity to see that they can earn some money doing something positive.
Yes, it also takes them off the street and it also builds them up, you know. It does not only give to them as well, they can also now give something back to the community and most importantly to their families, to their loved ones, you know.
And they all get somewhere to live as well?
Yes. We do find that a place where they can rent and from there they can kickstart their life. And then once their life is fine, then we focus on tracing their parents so that they can also, you know, like, go back and then show them that they've changed. So, you know, and give something back to their parents and give hope.
What an inspirational thing to do. And so what's the best thing that visitors to Johannesburg can do?
Can you please repeat that?
What's the best thing that visitors here can do? I'm guessing it's buying some of the artwork.
It's buying some of the artwork and also learning a little bit about Joburg because that's what mainly we're all about. And yeah, asking stories and we'll let you know. And also the booth, just to have fun, you know. Basically, yeah.
Come that's and see
it.
You.
Yes,
come and check
please
it out.
Please come and check it out. Wherever you are, come. This is called I Was Shot in Joburg, not with a gun, but with a camera.
Perfect. I love it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was nice.
That was me reporting from Maboneg in Johannesburg, South Africa, a former no-go area of the city, which has seen regeneration and inspiring projects like I Was Shot in Joburg that have the power to turn underprivileged young people's lives around, a cause very close to my heart. If you can, do visit their online store at iilovelocal.com and check out their Facebook page. Times are tough right now, and it's a great way to make sure we don't lose brilliant initiatives like this in cities like Johannesburg. Speaking of cities, you probably are not surprised that city breaks aren't really my bag, Sure, I love to spend a couple of days in one and explore on foot or bike, meet locals, that kind of thing. But for me, the urban centres are access points to access the countryside beyond. And that means choosing a city where the outdoors is literally on the doorstep. Want to know where the best ones are that offer escape close to town? Listen up, it's time for my regular top 10. That's right, this episode we're looking at the best cities around the world if you're an outdoor lover. So let's jump right in. In at 10, it's Tallinn, Estonia. Known more for stag parties than outdoor escapades. Do check out Wonder Woman episode 3 to hear more. There's a whole host of green spaces beyond the walls of the old town. Not to mention a bird-rich peninsula within 30-minute walk, and the incredible bogland, perfect for hiking and wild swimming, just a short drive away. Then, of course, there are the islands just off the coast. So much to explore. In at 9, over in Africa, it's Livingstone, Zambia, the jumping-off point for many a visit to the famous Victoria Falls. This place offers a cascade of outdoor pursuits, from walking safaris to microlight flights, swimming in the Devil's Pool, and whitewater rafting. At 8, it's La Fortuna in Costa Rica, the gateway to the Arenal Volcano National Park. It literally is steps away from a hike up to its namesake peak, which is still active, by the way. It also on offer are Class 3 and 4 rapids, perfect for rafting, stand-up paddleboarding on the lake, and the chance to rappel or abseil down jungle waterfalls. In at 7, we're in sunny Scotland for the ski town of Aviemore. Yes, okay, it's more of a town than an actual city per se, but it's easily accessible from Inverness Airport as well as from the Caledonian Sleeper Train. Once there, in summer, there's hikes, cycle trails and wildlife watching opportunities galore. In winter, there's skiing, reindeer walking and even husky sledding. A real Arctic adventure right here in Britain. In at 6, Innsbruck in Austria grabs your attention. Not only can you access the mountains via an easy and quick cable car ride straight from the centre, but also you can take your mountain bike for some of the best downhill trails going. There's also bobsleighing in the summer, and in the winter, over 500 kilometres of ski and snowboard trails. In at 5, we head over to the USA and Fort Collins in Colorado. Within the city limits, there's 50 parks, 280 miles of hiking and biking trails, and opportunities to go bird watching, horse riding, and snowshoeing and fat biking in winter. Plus, it's home to some great post-adventure breweries. We'll say cheers to that. In at 4, it's Queenstown, New Zealand, an easy contender. It even calls itself the adventure capital of the world, and it's clear to see why. On offer is jet boating, skydiving, mountain climbing, cycling, skiing, snowboarding. Oh, and did I mention this is the place where bungee jumping was invented? Take a leap, if you dare. In at 3, it's Pokhara, Nepal. Here you can sample nearly every outdoor activity you can think of. On steroids. Thinking of paragliding? How about paragliding with hawks? Fancy a spot of rafting? How about 25 kilometres of river? Then, of course, there's hiking. Himalayas, anyone? In at 2, just missing out on the top spot, is Vancouver in Canada's British Columbia. But this is certainly up there with the best. It's got parks, a waterfront, trails for bikes, hiking, Grouse Mountain for a proper workout with city views, kayaking, and easy access to superb ski areas on Vancouver Island as well, home to a hearty population of black bears. In at 1, it has to be Ushuaia, Argentina. Most know it as the jumping-off point for many an expedition ship headed to the mighty white of Antarctica, which in itself virtually guarantees it a top spot on this list. But there's more to see even on the doorstep, from Tierra del Fuego National Park with hiking and camping opportunities galore, all of which can be easily reached from an inexpensive bus in the middle of town, as well as a city-side glacier to hike to, and easy and quick boat rides out to see penguins. When do we leave? Oh, I do love a city with a side portion of wilderness. They're great for appeasing travel partners who like to enjoy all the trappings of a busy urban centre, while you can go knowing that walking and wildlife is never too far away. However, we all know that when there is wildlife and wilds, there's often, sadly, biting insects too, and no one wants to ruin their travels with multiple insect bites. So how do you beat the bugs? Easy. With a little help from my Wonder Woman podcast partners, Rohan. Welcome to my much-loved Wonder Woman gear slot, presented in association with Rohan, ensuring that wherever you go, you don't have a kit astrophy. See what I did there? This month I'm talking travel shirts designed to keep the bugs at bay. Sitting in the comfort of my own home, I can picture hiking in jungles or in deserts or wildlife watching on safari and easily forget one of the blights of those activities wherever it's done. From Borneo to Brazil and even on Ben Nevis. That's right, who can forget the midges found on the highest peak in Britain? We all know that you can try insect repellent, but it smells, is often sticky and doesn't always work. But there is another way, and that is to buy clothing that is treated to repel biting critters. That's where Rohan's travel shirts come in. Many are treated with Insect Shield, aka permethrin, an invisible and odourless ingredient that helps protect you against insects such as mosquitoes, ticks, ants, flies, chiggers and midges. I've been testing out one such model called the Tian shirt, on sale for £59. I've worn it in the Australian outback, on safari in South Africa, wandering around Chitwan National Park in Nepal, and even in the evenings when on a dive trip to St. Lucia in the Caribbean. Its fabric is soft, and handily also offers good protection against the sun, being rated UPF 40+. It doesn't smell of repellent at all, and the repellent that it's impregnated with will last for the life of the shirt, meaning you don't need to worry about re-impregnating it when the repellent kind of fades. But for me, I love the fact that it fits a bit looser than some shirts, so easily goes over a vest or a t-shirt if you need a quick cover-up, and allows decent airflow so that you don't get too hot. It doesn't crease, handy for a woman like me who doesn't believe in ironing, and it dries quick, so if you need to wash it in the evening, it's ready to wear the next morning. For that, and for saving me the itch of bug bites, it wholeheartedly comes Wonder Woman approved. Thanks very much to my friends at Rohan for supporting Wonder Woman on her travels. Do check out their website, rohan.co.uk. And remember, Wonder Woman listeners can get a 10% discount at the checkout by using the code WWN9. That was my monthly dose of gear chat, ploughing through the marketing speak to help you work out what you really need on the road. While we're discussing a life on the road, perhaps one group of people who spend more of theirs on it than most are full-time athletes. From training trips to competing in the Olympics, they head to some pretty far-flung places across the globe. But do they actually get to see much while they're there? As we were in strict lockdown due to the coronavirus while I was recording this episode, I couldn't go and speak to my next guest face-to-face. But we did manage to master an online chat. So without further ado, here's my next guest, Helen Glover, MBE, aka the woman who won the first gold medal for Team GB in London 2012. And now gets to travel for fun rather than work. Do listen out for her must-pack item. It's a cracking tip.
You are listening to the Wonder Woman podcast, and you join me speaking to Helen Glover, MBE, who was voted number one female rower in the world in 2015, two times Olympic champion, triple world champion, four times World Cup champion, has broken several records and Olympic records and World Cup records. Wow. Helen, hello.
Hi.
Can you remember each one of those records that you broke?
Do you know what? Whenever anybody asks me about individual races, it's all a blur, to be honest.
So I have to ask, were you always sporty growing up?
Yeah, I think sport was very much identity for me when I was growing up. If you asked anybody in my class about me, I was a sporty one. And I think that gave me that sense of who I was, what I enjoyed. I was quite naturally sporty, more than I was academic. So it kind of just, it was a bit of a natural fit for me.
And the rowing, was that something that you were always interested in, or did you sort of fall into that later?
Much later, yeah. I had never met a rower, never didn't know anything about rowing until I was 21, just about 4 years before London 2012. And yeah. I had been a runner, a hockey player, dabbled in lots of sports to reasonable levels. And then when London got the bid for the Olympic Games, they did talent ID, talent testing, and I got put into rowing. And literally, I didn't know anything about it. And it was suggested that I should start rowing. I got given a coach, and that was it.
Wow. And I think part of the appeal of being an Olympic athlete and competing in these things is the amount of travel that you get to do. So you've competed in places like Sydney, Rio, South Korea, all over Europe. But I have to ask, do you actually get any time to see the places that you're in when you're doing this?
Not really. I mean, we go on lovely training camps, these amazing places, and obviously a benefit is that you are on kind of predictable water. Usually you go places with predictable weather, and you live in this hotel where you get your catering, so you don't have to cook your meals and go shopping. But other than that, you just see the same lake, and they're usually beautiful places, but no, you don't see the sea very much of the area. The one difference is every year we get 3 weeks off after the main event, so after the World Championships or the Olympics. And so wherever you end up there, you're usually traveling. And I was really lucky. My championships was out in New Zealand. I've done South Korea and, you know, Rio. And so I've been to some really cool places along the way.
Well, out of all those ones that you were in and competed and got to travel afterwards, do you have a favourite one that you look back on? Not just because of what happened, obviously, in the races, but the actual place?
I would say for somewhere that I wouldn't have gone otherwise, South Korea was this kind of a cultural difference. I found it really interesting. I found the people everyone was just so lovely. It was an incredible country to go to, and I would not have gone there if it wasn't for rowing. But in terms of somewhere that just drew me in, New Zealand, I fell in love with. It very much kind of got my character, I think. I grew up in Cornwall, and so the coast and the rolling hills and all these things really reminded me of home, but in this like awesomely epic film set kind of way. And so I really kind of clicked with New Zealand.
And then since 2016 you've not been competing, but have you managed then, has that meant you've had more time to travel and see more places than it did perhaps when you were full-time athlete?
Yeah, definitely. I think when you're a full-time athlete, you're so focused, and like in your downtime you're not thinking about traveling or seeing places, you're thinking about rest and recovery and not injuring yourself, basically. So year after Rio, I pretty much wanted all the most dangerous things I could find, so I went skiing and climbing and kayaking and canoeing and did just kind of everything that I wasn't allowed to do.
Of course, suddenly the world is your oyster, you just throw yourself at things.
I can break my leg and no one's going to tell me off. But luckily I didn't break any bones. I'm married to Steve Backshall, who was traveling that year a lot for his expedition series anyway. So I did a lot of training with him when he was climbing, and so that was great. Went out and did some climbing together. We did a big kayaking race, the Divisor to Westminster. We did that together. We also went skiing, and also I managed to travel a bit. Once we had Logan, our first little boy, he came out with us to some of Steve's filming, which was just the most amazing experience, really.
Wow, and how different did you find it traveling with a little one versus going on your own or just you and Steve?
Oh, totally different. So the first year, so Steve does, usually every year he goes to Australia and does about a month there doing a stage tour. And the first year I went out and I was on my own, and I was still sort of as fit as an Olympian. So I was going off on my bike and just kind of pick a point on a map and cycle to it. And if it looks exciting, it probably is, because it's Australia and everything's really cool. So you cycle to an amazing beach or a mountain or, you know, just a nature reserve, and you could just do it off your own steam. So I was just doing that every day while Steve was working. And then the next year I went when Logan was with me, and obviously I couldn't put him on the back of a bike, but it made me look at things a really different way. And actually I enjoyed the things I saw more. It slowed me down. It made me really take in the views. If I needed to stop and feed him, I would choose the most stunning beach you could imagine. I'd be sat there feeding the baby and making sure I was taking it all in. So actually it was still a massive adventure in a different way.
And I love that idea of it made you stop and actually sort of smell the roses, enjoy the views and do that kind of thing. I mean, is it still important to you that when you do travel, either by yourself or as a family, that you include sort of physical activities like cycling, or would you go rowing, for example, or is that sort of no, never again?
I think rowing's like the worst way to see anything. I've never seen a kingfisher rowing. I've never seen all these, you know, all these birds and all these things that Steve talks about on the river. Because you're going backwards, everything's scared away by the time you get to it. But paddleboarding, canoeing, kayaking, cycling, all of those things, I have fallen in love with even more since Rio, and since Steve and I have had the chance to do more of them together. And absolutely, we kind of base any trips we go on, we base around what physical activity we're going to be doing.
Brilliant. And the thing about water, that sort of taps into what you were saying before about going slower. I think when you see places from the water, not when you're competing and trying to beat a time or a personal best, it is a much more slow and soothing way to see the place, isn't it?
There's something calming about water. We're fortunate enough to live by the River Thames. And at home, I was about in Cornwall, we were about a mile from the beach. So water's always been a really big part of my life. And it is soothing and calming. And like you say, if you're not doing some kind of race, then it can be a really, really therapeutic way to get about.
And of course, we're talking now during the lockdown, so all our travels are sort of on hold for now. Is there anywhere you're particularly dreaming of going on holiday to once this is all over?
Well, I'm always drawn back to Cornwall and my family home. And I think Steve and I both have this kind of craving to go there. It feels very kind of free and open. And when you're, like you say, when you're confined to one space, you think of the biggest spaces you can. And for me, they were the open beaches that I used to run on and train on. And I think you can hear Logan screaming in the background.
I can hear, yeah.
He's woke up from his nap. So for me, the biggest and most exciting places were the sand dunes that we want to take Logan sledging on, and the beaches and the sea. And just definitely taking a trip to Cornwall is pretty much first on the to-do list after lockdown.
And how about abroad? Because obviously you are now a mum of three. We heard Logan screaming nicely for us before, but now you're a mum of three, so congrats. But is there somewhere abroad that you'd like to take all three of them that you're desperate for them to see?
Yeah, I think Steve's Australia trip that we've done a couple of times, once with Logan, is something that I just would love to be able to do with the three of them. I really loved the fact that we could go as a family and just go to the most remote places, and you could pick any beach and it would be, you think, how is this not the world's most beautiful beach and there's not one person on it? And
yeah,
we could have the most incredible wildlife experiences that felt like they were just your own. And so I think, yeah, going back to Australia would be, but also the mountains as well. Steve and I, very early on when we first started dating, went out to France, the mountains, and I couldn't ski. He was out skiing and I couldn't ski, so we just loads of hiking and walking and sledging and snowball fights with the little ones and stuff like that. Like you say, things change and you have a different perspective on travel when you have a family, but I think that definitely snow will be a good way to experience it together as well.
Definitely, and keep the kids occupied as well, I can imagine.
Totally.
It's quite important.
Tie them out.
And finally, obviously we've heard the kind of things that you like when you go and travel somewhere, but is there one piece of kit or travel gear that you would never leave for a trip without?
Probably my trainers. I think that walking or running is just a really great way to explore the area. Just getting out and about on your feet. And I think there's something about being in a different country which makes, for me, it makes me more confident in speaking to people and asking locals questions. I remember when I went to Australia, I was desperate to see a koala in the wild. And
yeah,
I just walked down the road and I asked every single person I could see. And I said, have you seen the koala? I was in this area that's near a nature reserve. It was just a random street in the city. And I went out to Alaska when Steve was filming there. I did a mountaineering course out there.
Yeah.
And I wanted to see humpback whales. And I remember just going for a run. Yeah. And pretty much every person I saw, which was not many because it was in Juneau and there weren't many people there,
yeah,
I asked if they'd seen humpbacks. And finally, this one woman said, yes, I'll tell you the bay to go to. And it was about 10 kilometres away. And I ran there and I saw a humpback feed, these humpbacks bubble feeding.
Oh, wow.
And it was just... And I just thought I would never at home sort of think to just ask a random lady in her garden, have you seen anything cool nature-wise, and just follow her directions and run 10 kilometres. And it really paid off. So, yeah, I would say bring your trainers and an open mind, and you never know what you're going to see.
Oh, I think that's the perfect way to end it. Helen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Olympian and world champion rower Helen Glover. Even in lockdown, having only recently given birth to twins, she's already paddling around on the water and having mini adventures with her husband, TV naturalist Steve Backshall. Do follow her adventures on Twitter at HelenGloverGB. And just like that, it's near the end of the episode. So time for me to share with you my utterly incredible Wonder Woman of the Month. I hope you've enjoyed what you've heard. If you have, please do subscribe so you never miss an episode. And please, please, please do leave a review. It means so very much, especially during these trying times. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Phoebe R. Smith. Go to my website, phoebe-smith.com, where you can sign up for my newsletter and get in touch with me. And of course, do check out my friends at rohan.co.uk, where you can enter the code I gave earlier at the checkout and get a discount off your entire order. Now, think flying and famous aviators, and most will name the Wright brothers. But there were a great many female pilots who achieved incredible things, in spite of their gender definitely holding them back. In the case of this month's Wonder Woman of the Month, our heroine not only had to fight against gender norms of the time, but also against prejudices towards African American women. So, without further ado, introducing my Wonder Woman of the Month. In the midst of the First World War, there was a young manicurist called Bessie Coleman. She was in her early 20s and working in a barber shop in Chicago, USA. Her brothers, who served in the military, returned from France and told her stories of their time in Europe. As Bessie listened, she was entranced, even more so when she heard that over on the continent, women were allowed to fly planes. As a young African-American born in 1892, this was not something she thought she could ever do. She grew up helping her mother pick cotton and do laundry in Texas, and she had to save all her money to try and get an education, only to have to drop out after one semester as she could no longer afford the fees. She moved to Chicago to be with her brothers, which is when her passion to take to the skies was ignited. Once she'd heard about it, that women could fly over in France, she couldn't get the idea out of her head, and so applied to every flight school in the USA, but was rejected, as she was both black and a woman. Doing some research, she learned that if she went to France, she could possibly get into an aviation school, and so she applied, meanwhile teaching herself French in her own time in the evenings. Finally, she was accepted into the Caudron Brothers School of Aviation, and in 1921 received her international flying license. Pursuing her dream of one day owning her own plane and starting a flight school, she began to learn how to do flight tricks, such as loop-the-loop, tail spins, and figure of eights. She began doing talks in schools and theatres, showing footage of her escapades, encouraging women to take up flying, and also refusing to appear in places where segregation by race was still practised. She managed to earn enough to buy her own aircraft and performed in air shows both in her home country and across the seas in Europe. She survived a crash in 1923, but this did not put her off, and she still took to the skies doing mind-blowing tricks. As her popularity grew, she was asked to perform back in her home state of Texas, where they wanted the crowd to enter by two separate gates, one for blacks and one for whites. She steadfastly refused unless everyone entered by the same gate, and won her demand, a landmark achievement given the time and place. Sadly, while a passenger in a test flight with a mechanic, she was thrown from the plane as it spun out of control and she fell to her death, and the mechanic also perished in the wreckage. She was just 34 years old. And the press? They barely mentioned her, many not at all, focusing instead only on the male mechanic. For pushing boundaries in so many ways, in the battle of the sexes and in the fight for equality for black women, as well as having aviation skills as a pilot, Bessie Coleman receives our hearty salute as this episode's Wonder Woman of the Month. I hope that has inspired a great many of you to realise that any obstacle can be overcome. Let's hope we work together going forwards to ensure that many more glass ceilings are shattered for both members of the BAME community and for women everywhere. In the next episode of the Wonder Woman podcast, I head to Finland, going back to basics, foraging for food just outside Helsinki before discovering the Lake District region to the north. I also chat to Professor Minky, aka Dr. Alistair Birtles, the man who discovered and now fights to protect and research the rare dwarf minke whale in the Coral Sea. I also offer you my top tips for finding a company who can help you watch wildlife responsibly. I give you my verdict on a cap designed to not only look good, but also protect you and your head and neck from the sun, all while repelling biting insects, in association with my podcast partners, Rohan. I also offer you a high top 10 with my pick of the mountains around the world you just have to put on your to-climb list. And I chat to filmmaker of BBC's recent Climbing Blind documentary, Al Lee, to find out whether he prefers working in Antarctica or the tropics, and get him to confess the kit he simply won't leave home without. See you then. Wonder Woman out. The Wonder Woman podcast is written and edited by me, Phoebe Smith. The producer for this episode is Daniel Nielsen. The wonderful logo was designed by John Summerton, and the photograph is by Claire Rodley. Thanks to our podcast partner, Rohan, and this episode, thanks also to Destination Canada, who helped Daniel journey to the wild and remote Torngats. To learn more about Canadian destinations, you can follow at Explore Canada. A final thanks to all the people I met on my journey and were willing to talk to me. It's because of you that this podcast is able to happen at all.
Hello, my name is Phoebe Smith, and I want to tell you about my book, Wayfarer, Love, Loss and Life on Britain's Ancient Paths. Wayfarer tells the story of how I lost my way and found it again by walking the ancient pilgrim paths in Britain and elsewhere. Along my journey, I found hope, confronted past experiences, and learned more about myself than I ever thought I would. My book, Wayfarer, is out now and available in hardback, ebook, and audiobook.